This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, whether it's at sea level or 6,000 feet, like we're going to hear about today, there are men and women around you, maybe right next door, right down the street, around the corner, who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget about that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear a story today from Prescott, Arizona. And I've heard, is this true, Bill Schrader, that Prescott, Arizona bills itself as everybody's hometown?
I guess so. I think so.
Well, it's about time that Hometown Heroes made it to everybody's hometown here in Prescott, Arizona, where the air is thin and clean and clear. And I guess you can see, what, 100 miles off your back porch here?
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad place to be.
No. Beautiful. Beautiful.
And you saw a lot of different things during World War II. We're going to talk about that, talk about B-24s, your position on a B-24 crew in the Pacific. But let's start before that. Growing up in Southern California, what were your ambitions growing up? I'm sure you weren't thinking, hey, I'm going to go fly a B-24 in a war that hasn't happened yet. What were you thinking? What were you expecting?
I wanted to be a dentist.
All right.
Of all things. But I just couldn't make it. I didn't have the grades to do it.
I like to ask every veteran about December 7th, 1941, because everybody seems to remember something about that day. And a lot of the folks from Southern California I've talked to have some pretty crystal clear memories. What do you remember about that day?
Well, about noontime, that was a Sunday, my folks came home with a brand new Chevrolet. They didn't know the war had started. And so that was a big thing, a brand new car in our family. So that's what I remember, of course. And that same car, as a 17-year-old, I totaled it.
Oh, no.
And I had to buy my mother a new car. And there was no new cars then. So what I had to do then is, you know, shop the market and look for one. But a 1941 Chevrolet in 1943 was $1,400 and some dollars. The brand new Chevrolet was $840. That's how fast they jumped up.
And that's how the war impacted everything in America at that time. When you heard that news, I know you were just a very young man. What were you?
I was 14, 15? Well, at that time I was 13 and a half, 14, I forget.
Yeah. So I'm sure that you have no idea that this is going to affect you at some point.
Not really, no.
Was it still a jolt, though, to hear that your country, even though it's way out there in the Pacific, that America had been attacked?
I think it was a very serious thing, even for teenagers, because, you know, you didn't know what was going to happen. That was the thing.
Sure. And I've heard stories from folks who lived in the L.A. area, and you were in West L.A., about blackouts at night, having to turn out all the lights.
We had those, yes.
I've heard about, you know, fears of the Japanese attacking the California coast.
There was a submarine off the coast of Santa Barbara.
Right. So did that make you a little nervous?
I don't even know if I thought about it that much.
From the folks I've talked to, it sure sounds like it did kind of change the way of life for a while there, though.
Well, you had to blacken everything. Blackouts were on, so that happened immediately, yeah.
When did you start to get the idea, as this war continued on, that you might have to become part of it?
Probably when guys were going in the service so fast. Everybody that was graduating was going in the service, or that could go.
What high school did you go to?
University High School, Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. So you were thinking, I've got to do something here before Uncle Sam drafts me. I'm going to choose my own path, or what?
Basically, no question about that. I saw all the newsreels, saw the guys on the ground getting just murdered. So I wanted to go in the Air Corps, because at that time it was the Air Corps. It wasn't the Air Force.
Right. And a lot of those planes were being manufactured there in Southern California.
Right, right. B-24s were manufactured down in San Diego.
And just about every Army Air Corps veteran that I've spoken to, whether he was a navigator, bombardier, gunner, pilot, whatever, they all say they went in thinking, I'm going to be a pilot. Was that your ambition?
That is exactly mine. I wanted to be a cadet. I signed up in August of 43, but I wasn't 18 yet, so I couldn't go until I was 18.
How'd your folks feel about you doing that?
Well, my folks, my dad went off to do war work. My mother said no. That was it, but she had no choice.
You know, and when you say that, my dad went off to do war work for you, that's a matter-of-fact statement. I think for a lot of people today, they say, well, what does that mean? I mean, they don't have a concept of how all-encompassing this war was at the time. What was he doing, and where did he have to go?
He was an electrician building. Well, you know, I truthfully don't know what he was building. He tried to get in the shipyards, but for some reason he went out of state.
Well, and it just goes to show you, this affected everybody, and everybody had a piece of it. So you decide the Air Corps, you wanted to be a pilot. Was there a particular plane that you were thinking, oh, if I can ever get in the
cockpit of that?
I
wanted to be a P-51 pilot, naturally. A fighter pilot.
Just heard that engine once and it sold you, huh?
Hell yeah.
But obviously, there were other plans for you. So how did that course change for you from being a pilot to what you ended up doing?
Well, when we went to basic training, most of us were all washed out because they didn't need pilots anymore because I was young at 18, so there was no place for pilots and navigators. So I said, well, I still want to fly, so what can I do now? They said, do you want to be a gunner? I said, sure. So I became a gunner.
Had you been much of a marksman before? Had you had much experience?
Never.
So how did they whip you into shape and teach you how to fire a gun from a speeding bomber?
Just lots of training.
What did that training consist of? What kinds of things did you guys do?
Well, you learn how to take a 50 caliber machine gun apart, put it together, and then they would fly you in B-24s, air to ground and air to targets that they would tow.
I've talked to some of those tow pilots, and that always kind of fascinated me. I wonder what they were thinking when everybody was shooting at them.
You know, the target was about 100 feet behind them, so...
But you and I both have met people with really bad aim, haven't we?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Did it take you a while to get the hang of it, or did you pick it up real quick?
I seemed to just flow into it, yeah.
And as far as your mindset, were you one of those guys who was eager to get over and see some action because you knew so many were already doing that, or were you just fine taking your time?
No, I wanted to get going, yeah.
When did that happen for you?
We left the States in April of 45. See, so yeah, I was late, real late.
But there were some important things that happened after you got there.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of times just the journey getting there is pretty eventful as well. Was it at all difficult for you to leave and wonder if you're going to make it back?
No, I never even thought of that.
Tell me about the crew that you were with, because I look at your wall here, and you have a picture of your crew, and each member of that crew who's no longer with us is marked with a little cross. And you're still there. You don't have a cross on your chest yet, and there's three other guys on that crew that don't. And then you even have pictures of all of you when you got together 50 years after the war. I get the feeling that you guys were a pretty tight-knit group.
We never saw each other before that. From 50 years, we didn't see each other.
But before you went into combat, how well did you know these guys? How much trust did you have with these other members of your crew?
Well, we got together in December of 44, and immediately we met each other in Lincoln, Nebraska, and we went by train to Boise, Idaho, and that's where we trained. And in April of 45, we left to go overseas.
But you got to stay with that same crew that you had trained all those months with.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Not everybody had that luxury.
No. Some of those poor guys that were in the real deep combat, they lose them. They replace people.
Well, tell me about the camaraderie that you guys had among that crew, because I've heard all different ends of the spectrums when it comes to that.
Well, we were friendly, but we certainly didn't associate with the pilot and the officers. But my buddy was my radio operator, and he was from California, too. So that's why we just chummed around together.
And what better way to prepare you from the weather you're going to face in the Pacific than to send you to Gowan Field in Boise, Idaho? Huh?
We trained all high-altitude missions and went over to the Pacific. We never flew over 15,000.
Such is the nature of the uncertainty of war.
Huh? Well, that's for sure. And how do they know where you're going to go? You know, when and why. And so they send you where they got to send you.
Was it a bit of an adventure for a teenager?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes. Yeah, because we flew and we landed on about five islands to refuel. And we finally wound up in New Guinea, of all places. And then from New Guinea, we went to the Philippines.
Were you excited at the chance to fly your first mission? Were you shaking in your boots? How would you describe the way you felt before that first assignment?
I wouldn't say I was shaking my boots, and I don't know. It's just something that you did. It was coming. And maybe if we saw a fighter plane coming at us, it might change my mind. But I didn't see that. Thank goodness.
I would imagine that would be the situation where the responsibility rests on you. If a fighter plane's coming right at you head on, you're the nose gunner, right? That's your job.
I was the nose gunner, yeah. Well, if he's coming from the north direction.
Tell us about that. What does it feel like to be in the nose of a B-24 in a combat situation? What do you see in front of you, and what is that experience like? Because you see everything before anybody else does,
right?
Everything.
I was leading my crew.
What were you guys there to do? What kinds of targets did you have? What would a typical mission for you consist of?
Well, because of the lateness that we were there, we saw no air-to-air combat. Most of ours was ground strafing.
You guys were doing the strafing, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have anti-aircraft fire from the ground?
No. Again, it was late. So we were all packed up, ready to move the day they dropped the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And that changed the whole thing. Now we're going to go home. We're not going to go. We were all scheduled to go to Okinawa to hit Japan proper.
Right. So the missions that you got in, you flew eight missions there at the end
eight
of the war.
Missions, that's all.
And this was Fifth Bomb Group?
The 23rd Squadron of the Fifth Bomb Group of the 13th Air Force.
Right. So you guys had a nickname, I believe, in that bomb group.
Jungle Bomber. No.
Jungle Air Force?
No.
Bomber Barons?
Bomber Barons.
Well, the time that you were over there, from April of 45 till the end of the war, so that's a good 4 months there. What was life like? I mean, what kinds of things did you spend your time doing?
Well, my radio operator and I, when you went flying, you had nothing to do, really. Maybe a little ground school, but very little. We would do anything, hike around the island. We bought a motorcycle together, of which we took one ride on. We hit the front wheel brakes and skidded out, and I said, we took the motorcycle right back and said, no.
Lesson learned. Huh?
Yes, real quick.
I'm sure a lot of people listening have no idea what one of these bombing missions would be like, how long it would take, what the conditions are, the kinds of things that you see. Can you give us a little taste of that, a little perspective?
Well, it was rather boring because they were 14-hour flights.
And 14 hours. And people are not used to flying 14. That alone.
In those days, though.
Well, even today, I mean, you put someone on a 14-hour flight, I mean, unless they're going halfway around the world, they don't know what that feels like. And that alone is a test of your willpower and concentration, I would think. That sounds pretty grueling.
No, you didn't know what to do while you were flying. We played a lot of dice. Mm-hmm. With the crew. But no, it was nothing to do. You just maybe catnap along the way.
And what starts to happen on your B-24 when you guys get within range of the bombing target?
The pilot tells you to get in your turrets, and we'll keep looking out for everything. So that's what we did. Our final mission was to sight shipping. The Japanese ships were flying white flags, and that's what we were looking out for constantly, is any ship that was Japanese, were they flying a white flag? And if they weren't, we were supposed to report it to the pilot, and they were supposed to report it.
So it wasn't that you guys were going to bomb someone if they weren't?
Not on that day.
Really surveillance?
Yeah, no, that wasn't our job. Mm-hmm. Just to spot them. Most of that flight was down the Chinese coast.
Where were you flying from? Where was your base?
New Guinea. And then when we were in the Philippines, the island of Samar.
I'm sure you saw a few things that you hadn't seen in West L.A.
That's for sure.
You had your own monkey?
I bought a monkey while I was over there.
Well, we've got to hear how that turned out, but we need to take a break. Bill Schrader of Prescott, Arizona is our guest today. Before we're done, we'll also hear from his daughter, who has made a huge difference in the lives of World War II veterans in Arizona through the Honor Flight program. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.